Mike was one thing you really didn't stress enough, I think, is just the horrors of the IMF, right? And particularly when you come to trying to relate Omega to the extra-galactic background light, I think it's just really an awful situation, because even if you assume a saltpeter IMF, of course, you don't know what the bottom still mass cut off is, right? And there's some evidence of turn off over below one solar mass and all the rest of this now, but it really is rather horrid. Yeah. But then I wanted to go on to make my remark, of course, and in fact, I mean, the metallicity determination is not horrible.
That's what's going to be my answer to your first part.
And that's the correct answer. But then, to go...
But it's not completely correct. I'll get to that.
But then I wanted to go on and draw my conclusion, right?
Yeah.
Which is to go back to this issue of the cost of metallicity, because
yeah.
I think you really can't put a very high metallicity into a distributed intergalactic medium with current Omega feed from the ground synthesis. I mean, probably about the highest level you can put in is about a tenth or 2 tenths solar.
I agree. Right.
And then I think if people want to try and extrapolate from the cluster of metallicities onto that, they're going to have to face up to the fact that the distributed IPM metallicity is super times.
Right. Okay. Let me just respond. Can I respond quickly to that? Yeah. Okay. So the IMF that's used here is one that does turn over at about a solar mass and ends at a tenth of a solar mass, and so it's at least consistent with what we see around us today. You're right to some extent if you normalize to the metallicity. Although even that is more when I actually looked at that, it was more sensitive. There's a sort of an idea that metals and light are 1-to-1, but there's actually about a factor of 2 or 3 there to play with. It's more than most... Sorry? Well, yeah, exactly. So if you're adding up bolometric light, there actually are still some big uncertainties there. So you do a little bit better with metals than you do with total mass of stars, but it's not a huge factor. And I agree with you on the point about the IGM and the cluster issue. And the thing I would say there to my friend Alvio Renzini especially is that, you know, the clusters are a small fraction of the mass of the universe, the rich clusters where the metallicity is measured in the X-ray. And they're clearly different in some ways. I mean, they have different stellar populations and different galaxies in them. So whether they really are representative or not of the IGM at large, I think is, in my mind, an open issue. Justin Kim, sure.
As concerning the last point, the fraction of variance in stars is not much different in the generic in the field than it is in clusters at zero redshift. So, having converted roughly the same proportion of variance into stars, one would expect the same amount of metals having been produced along with it. So, since in the clusters we can see how much metals there are, and the abundance is a third solar, I would say it's fairly straightforward to conclude that in the intergalactic medium itself cannot be much different from a third solar.
Well, I know you're, and I like you too, but I think it's really, we just have to determine this observation. What we need badly, I think, is, you know, we need absorption line studies of the low redshift Lyman alpha 4.
But I think it's wrong in the interpretation.
No, well, the yield, you can measure it in the clusters, and that is fully empirical. And it's a bit higher, in fact, than solar that you have assumed. A bit higher.
Paul.
The assumption is always made this is directed to Mike. The assumption is always made that whatever the radiation that comes out of stars is, you can account for it perhaps at a different wavelength, but as radiation. But we know, for example, that ionizing radiation inside the interstellar medium produces a lot of dynamical effects which don't necessarily come out as radiation, and some of those dynamical effects maintain the random thermal motion, I mean, random motions of gas in the interstellar medium. We can think of winds and adiabatic expansion. Are there other sinks that you need to take into account, or can you argue that that's not important?
I guess what you're asking is about kinetic energy, and whether that would essentially...
Or destroying dust grains. I mean, there are lots of modes that may not come back out as radiation.
I had a comment and question for Rachel and Cedric. I'll show tomorrow comparison between results of RSPH simulations and the Lyman Break galaxy luminosity function at redshift of 3. In the simulations, basically there's only the quiescent mode of star formation, or I think something that is closer to what you're calling the quiescent mode. And they actually, if anything, overproduce these the Lyman Break galaxies, or do about okay. So I think there is some difference between the way that you're modeling the quiescent formation and the way it's occurring in our simulations. I don't know which one's right.
Do you have any feedback in these simulations?
We don't. So possibly that, or well, we do have feedback, but it doesn't have a gigantic effect on the large galaxies. So possibly that is the difference, that there's a lot of feedback in the semi-analytic models, and that's what's causing you to have low star formation rates, and therefore you're going to bursts to push them back up. I don't know. But one actually particular question I have was what omega. I know, Cedric, you're using an omega B of 0.02,
right,
which is probably at least a factor of 2 lower than the best nucleosynthesis estimate for your H naught, and I wondered, Rachel, what you're using.
0.018.
What?
0.018.
0.018. So
H to the minus 2. H to the minus 2.
So you're using something
a factor
too higher than Cedric is. Right, but Cedric was using 0.02 period.
Period.
And a Hubble constant of 0.7.
Yeah.
So Rachel's is a factor of 2 higher.
Rachel's is right.
But it's a factor of 2 higher than Cedric. Okay. So this might explain part of the difference in Cedric's calculations, but not with Rachel's.
I think that based on just the semi-analytic work, we can actually understand the difference. And that does have to do with how in detail you model the quiescent star formation. So if you put a scaling, and this has been alluded to by Guinevere as well, if you put an explicit scaling of the star formation efficiency with dynamical time into the semi-analytic models, you are able to reproduce the luminosity function except at the very brightest end, and you are able to reproduce the overall counts of brighter than 25.5 Lyman Break galaxies. In your simulations, you have that same scaling with dynamical time in your star formation recipe. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you get similar results. And your box is only 11 H inverse megaparsecs. So you can't probe the very bright end of the luminosity function. But then you don't have the resolution. So, okay. No, but I think there's still actually a consistency between the semi-analytic models and the hydrosimulations if you do star formation in the same way. And I think what this is all boiling down to is that these results are very sensitive to the way that you model star formation. There's no magic in the gas cooling or the hydro or any of that. It's all in the star formation. One reason is that we find that you actually consume too much gas. So when we just put in this scaling with dynamical time, you consume too much gas and you violate the constraint from damped Lyman alpha systems. That's one reason. Another reason is, as I mentioned, the very brightest end of the LBG luminosity function, you don't get quite enough these very bright galaxies, and I think that also reflects Cedric's result that you don't get enough SCUBA sources. Those are the same objects, these very high star formation rate objects, you just won't get those. In the semi-analytics, no, in the semi-analytics, we have feedback. I did. In the semi-analytics, we have feedback. It's very schematic, of course, but it is in there in the usual way. Did you want to comment something?
It doesn't happen in the empirical model because the resolution doesn't allow you to form those small objects.
the overall star formation rate comes out different from what we're intending, though, because of the lack of those small objects.
But we're actually comparing to the luminosity function. So
exactly, but if you did have that extrapolation of small masses, you'd end up forming faster many stars by the present day.
I agree that the simulation forms too many stars by the present day, but it's still inconsistent with what.
This is in favor of Avi, against Mike. And so Mike's the one who will have to comment here. And I would say at some level against the semi-analytic modelers. When we didn't know that much, the universe was much more exciting in terms of possibilities, and it's all becoming extremely conventional, it seems. But there, I think, is a way out for that extra galactic background light diagram, which is a lot of, well, especially in the near-infrared, and the optical, it's assuming that the light is clustered. So the question is, what happens to those constraints if you throw out that assumption? For example, let us recall that decaying dark matter was always a fun thing to generate lots of action out there in the near-infrared. What we couldn't do was to put too much dust in the way because of the emerging limits from COBE, et cetera, and that's fine. We'll more or less deal with that. That's not too bad. The other thing, which was one of the great sources, which you cavalierly dismissed, I note, but that Avi would be quite happy with, we used to try and populate the universe at redshift 10 with a bunch of VMOs, and then we would tune it down to make sure that we got away from the unclustered background light limits. Question is, are we really stuck with those HDF limits, which I don't think we are, but are we really stuck with the bursting limits? Bernstein limits. Well, so the question is, you throw out the clustering aspect of the analyses, which includes source counting.
By clustering, you mean source counting?
Source counting or the fluctuation analysis that people do.
Well, I don't. This is. Let me answer the easy part. The Bernstein points, if that's what they are, not actually here. They have huge error bars, and I think they allow the light you see in galaxies to be all there is, but they also allow for twice as much. Okay, so that's what I was saying before. You could probably double this. You probably could get away with doubling this here. But since this is only half or a third of that, even if you double that, it doesn't change the total energy budget by very much. And I was working mostly with bolometric quantities. So it only changes things at the sort of 30% level at most.
But the number you were quoting was something like a 20th or so of the energy in the CMB, which is not bad to play with for the total integrated limit. And that was from the cluster.
These limits here, which you can't get away with, these are attempts to do absolute photometry. I think these are the old.
No, I know, but we always got around those.
Well, so, as
I
said,
pretty exotic
scenarios. If you put what you have to do with VMOs is you have to keep their mass down and the red. There's some place in the omega redshift plane.
Right.
And I perhaps I should have drawn it. And if you're on one side of that, you're okay. And if you're on the other side, you're not. And so, but clearly, if you put them at low enough redshift and try to make all the baryons, you're fried basically.
Absolutely.
By this.
So
you have to put it at high redshift, and you have to make it be less than the total baryon content, or you have to put it at high redshift.
Well, one per little galaxy is no problem.
Yeah, that's fine.
I have a simple question, and that's to Rachel and maybe the background people. That is, my understanding from what I've heard the last 2 days is that most of the Lyman Bright galaxies should in fact be galaxies that are in rich clusters today. So that means the integral of all the light that we've seen so far translates to only the stuff that we see in rich clusters today, which I assume is not a very large fraction of all the old stars that we see around us. So I'm trying to reconcile my understanding that there's, in fact, a lot of old stars outside rich clusters, and yet the integral of all the star formation, which is supposed to be peaked at the regime where we're looking at the Lyman breaks, somehow has to add up, and I don't know if it does or I'm confused.
I think that one of the differences in the starburst scenario that I was talking about is that those objects don't have to be all that massive. So like the simulation that I was showing was a halo with a circular velocity of 200 kilometers per second. So you could imagine that evolving into a Milky Way-sized galaxy. And as you could see from the plot that I showed, that does have a significant amount of star formation at high redshifts. So if you actually integrated up the ages of the stars, they come out to be quite consistent with... Right. We haven't actually...
No, that's not what people are saying. They're saying the ones that are in the big over-density end up in rich clusters.
Yeah.
The average neighborhood of such a thing today would be a group.
Yeah, so the ones that are in the spikes that Chuck and Kurt always show would be in rich clusters, but there's lots of them that are more spread out, and those might be, you know, in the local group. I think that's fine.
Eric?
My question is for the people who work on semi-analytic models. What is your clearest prediction that is testable? And please bear in mind that you're being recorded.
Okay, I don't know if for me there's one thing that stands out tremendously, but the general prediction of the hierarchical framework, which is most easily modeled right now semi-analytically, is basically that galaxies change over time, and that if you look at redshift 3, which is a substantial fraction of the age of the universe ago, that galaxies should not be the same as they are today, and I think that's really being borne out observationally. And of course, you know, there are many details. The galaxies may be smaller in size, they may, you know, have different properties, etc. And, I mean, that's a very general answer, and we're trying to work out many of those details. But that is in stark contrast to the more classical picture in which the general assumption was that galaxies are sort of in place and they maybe evolve passively because their stellar populations evolve. But that's quite different from the framework that we're looking at here.
You're going to find them to be strongly clustered. And well, it's a prediction of characteristics. It's an analytic model suggests a way to realize in practice the observable consequences of hierarchical clustering. So the analytic model is just a tool to take you from a power spectrum to observable properties. So that's what a analytic model is. And the prediction of clustering, for example, is quite generic to hierarchical clustering. And it was made before observations of clustering at high redshift. That's one example. Another quantity that's fairly robust is the median redshift of star formation, when have the stars formed. And that's around 1.5 or so. And that's testable, and it's been in press for 10 years. Now, I'm sure you can always make up a model that's sufficiently complex within hierarchical clustering that you could change the predictions, but you really have to go to extremes. And so there are, you know, there are things that are fairly robust, but of course there's a lot of uncertainties as well. But there's two examples there for you.
Let me make a prediction for something which hasn't been observed yet, because those are more convincing. And that is that if you go to redshifts, say between redshift 1.5 and 2, the abundance of galaxies with stellar mass of 10 to 11 solar masses and higher will be much smaller than it is today.
But I think the questioner asked
You wanted a definite prediction. So there,
but isn't there a big difference between all of the detail of the semi-analytical modeling machinery that we've heard about today and the very coarse-grained answers that you're giving now, which you could have made without doing all of
that? Yes, but that answer is completely different from the classical galaxy evolution, where the bright galaxies, the bright spirals and the ellipticals, and they were in place since redshift 3. So there's a complete difference.
What you're saying is what Colgar's matter predicts.
But I'm sorry, let me repeat what Carl says. A semiotic model is just a way to calculate what cold dark matter or another higher class can predict. Nothing else. It's just putting physics in the context of a cold dark matter model.
So the semiotic models are wrong cold dark matter?
Of course.
Okay. No. You can use semiotic. It's a tool. It's a tool. You can use semiotic models on any model you want. It's just a way to calculate. This is what physicists do. They calculate the consequences of the hypothesis. This is all it is.
Well, if you're asking about the details of recipes and how that can be tested, I think there are a few things that are starting to come together. One is that in a particular model, which Carlos, Sean Cole, Cedric, et cetera, looked at, which was put forward in 1994, there was very strong feedback in galaxies, and that was responsible for producing a flat luminosity function, and it was also largely responsible for producing a Medal plot that rolled over sharply. Those are both things that can be tested, and their group has now backed off of that model. They've changed their recipes, and they've adopted new recipes in which the feedback is not as strong. Another example is this example of the star formation recipe that we've been talking about. That's something that's changing because it's just not fitting the observations at high redshift. So those are two examples of ingredients that, you know, I think we have made progress in figuring out at least ones that don't work.
Can I make a philosophical comment? I mean, obviously there are many complex psychoanalytic models, so you may ask, when do I have a model that I can deem to be successful? And I would say that is when you have one model that can explain in a rather natural way a diverse set of phenomena. So if you can come up with a model that could explain naturally star formation history, the evolution of quasars, the formation of ellipticals, and the scuba sources all together, then I would say we've made progress, even though, you know, we have to parameterize certain things. So that's, I think that is the sort of way in which direction which you're aiming to go, to explain a diverse set of phenomena through one basic framework.
Then you have to think about the organizing. So we have to be familiar with this. Okay, so on that philosophical thing,